What sort of evidence would you expect to see if somebody said that they had encountered God? Would you expect that there would be some sort of transformation? I mean, if somebody said that they encountered the living God and then nothing in their life changed whatsoever, there was no difference in behavior, no difference in belief, no added hope or encouragement or peace in their life, we would just assume that either they had no encounter with God or whatever they perceived to be God was somewhat insignificant, wouldn't we? In fact, even today, as somebody claims to become a follower of Jesus Christ, we expect to see a radical transformation in their life, perhaps over time, but there should be some sort of obvious fruit in their lives. Last week, we left off with Jacob wrestling with God. We examined how brokenness led to blessing, how Jacob had come to this place of ceasing to strive and instead just holding on and through faith asking a blessing of God. And we found that God would provide such a blessing. And so we should expect that as we move forward, that Jacob is going to be a radically different man. He was a deceptive man. He was a weak man. He was the sort of man who would flee from his enemies. He was the sort of man who would lie. The question is, what would happen after he had this encounter with the Lord? I'm really looking forward to unpacking that with you today as we examine Genesis chapters 33 and 34. When we pick up our reading in the 33rd chapter, some of our Bibles might have the heading of Jacob meets Esau or something along those lines. What we might take for granted is the fact that 20 years have passed since Jacob last saw Esau, and that encounter was not what we would frame as a positive family experience. See, Jacob had stolen Esau's inheritance. Jacob and Esau's mother, Rebekah, had, for the sake of Jacob's safety, determined to have him flee from their presence so that his life might be spared. It's only then, you might remember, that Esau had discovered that his parents were displeased with the wives he had taken. And we might wonder, well, what sort of changes have happened in Esau's life in the last 20 years? You know, people become bitter about all sorts of things. They hold on to grudges, sometimes for things or over things that we think are somewhat insignificant. Throughout our lives, I trust all of us have had some sort of grudge that was really silly. Somebody beat us out for a spot on a sports team. We didn't get a promotion at some job we haven't worked at in 20 years. And yet we were bitter for some period of time towards somebody else. But Esau, his situation is a little different. He lost pretty much everything in that exchange. And yes, it was a consequence of his own immorality. And certainly he had demonstrated that he was a worldly individual. But if we put ourselves in Esau's shoes for a moment, we could see how we could justify the sin of bitterness, at least to ourselves. And I'm not saying that that's right, but I'm saying that in the human experience, sometimes we justify sin. And if I were Esau, it would have been really easy to do that given the circumstances. But we're going to step back here for a moment to Jacob. Jacob was this man who had fled from Esau's presence. Through his deception, through his mother's deception, they had lied, and he had stolen Esau's inheritance. And again, I talk about the blame and where that falls, and I have over the course of these episodes, but just looking at the base facts here, and certainly from Esau's perspective, that is what has taken place. But now Jacob has had encounters with the living God. And he wrestled with God, and he demanded a blessing, and God gave him one. So now we expect that Jacob is going to be a radically transformed individual. And that's exactly what you're going to find. It says, Jacob looked up, and there was Esau, coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two female servants. He put the female servants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. Now just think about this. This is was a previously deceptive man, a timid man, the sort of man who fled. Where is he here? He's in the front. And he's approaching, and he's doing so in humility. He's bowing himself to the ground 7 times as he approaches his brother, but he's leading. But what about Esau? It says, but Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. Who are these with you? He asked. Jacob answered, they are the children God has graciously given your servant. Then the female servants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all, Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Esau asked, what's the meaning of all these flocks and herds I met? To find favor in your eyes, he said. But Esau said, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. No, please, said Jacob. If I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me, for to see your face is like seeing the face of God. Now that you have received me favorably, please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need. And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. Look at how beautiful this picture is. And maybe it doesn't jump off the page at us because it's not our own family experience. But if you've ever had stress in your household, in your family, if there's ever been brokenness or division or years where people didn't talk, the words on the page just seem as sweet as honey. It is remarkable how God can restore broken relationships. 20 years have passed. Esau, from, as I said, his own perspective, could have come up with so many reasons to be bitter. And yet he isn't. He is overwhelmed at the sight of his brother. And Jacob, having been transformed by his encounter with the living God, is so radically transformed, his whole character is different. It's one day later. His character is radically different, and he is so excited to see his brother that it says that they wept. They embraced each other. He shares the blessings that he's received from the Lord with his brother Esau, who, after time here and a little bit of discussion, goes ahead and accepts that sort of blessing. There are times where believers start to think that reconciliation is not possible. Perhaps you are somebody who has fallen out of favor with another believer, with a family member, with a friend. Perhaps you're somebody who looks at your life and you say, look, this relationship is so broken, it could never be restored. But I want to encourage you with 2 stories. One of the first churches that I pastored, there were 2 women who had a personal falling out over 20 years before I met either one of them. And they didn't speak. And this wasn't a particularly large church. It wasn't like one of these gigantic mega churches with multi-campuses, and you know, you could attend one of them and never, ever encounter the other person. This was a very small community with pretty much just a few families in it. You had to not just, you know, see people periodically, you had to do business with these families because that's all that you had. This is not a major city where there are all these different possible places to go. And this church didn't exactly have a lot of places to hide. It was just a rectangle. And there weren't even 100 people in the average worship service. And so it was inevitable that they would run into each other. But even with all of that context, they had gone over 20 years without speaking. Not one time. You know, you do meet and greet in church and they would go the other way. And I didn't know about that dynamic in their relationship or lack thereof initially. But once it was pointed out to me, it was sort of obvious to see. In fact, they both kind of responded almost like it was their nature to just like push away from each other without really ever acknowledging that the other person even existed, which was really fascinating to see in a community like that. Well, having sat down and began speaking to these women individually and praying about the situation, they got to a place where they could have a breakthrough, and they talked, and their friendship was restored. And it was restored. They had lost all of this time together, but God was able to radically transform a situation that was broken. Throughout the years that I've pastored, I can't tell you how many times people have left a church They've left a church without ever addressing a situation, an offense that they had from somebody else, anger or bitterness that they had in their heart towards somebody. They just left. Well, the problem with that is multifold, but just to address one of those, the reality is that when I've had the opportunity to sit down across the table from two believers who were in conflict with one another, if they've been willing to sit down and talk after praying and having a sensitive heart open to receiving what the other person is willing to share, almost universally, those relationships have been restored. The shame is, though, many believers never get to that place where they actually sit down and talk. The next story I want to share with you, and this is more of a personal one, but when I was in high school, I was backslidden pretty significantly. I had a broken relationship with my mom. We did not talk for 3 years. I had no relationship with my mom at all. And that allowed myself to become incredibly bitter. Lots of things were going on in life. And of course, we live in a fallen world. People make choices that we don't always agree with. And that goes to both sides, both parties in this narrative. And I say narrative, to describe this story, this historical story from my own life, but personal anecdote, whatever you want to say. And I really was bitter. Well, I had been a backslidden Christian. I went to a college for a weekend at Liberty University as sophomore, junior. I think it was a junior in high school. And I had made this recommitment to the Lord. And we were on the way back from this event in our youth group in one of those 15-passenger vans that are like grossly unsafe, but we're kind of talking and singing and having a good time, and I'm filled with joy in the Lord. And this girl in my youth group says to me, "Well, God has forgiven you of so much." And I said, "Oh my, more than you could even begin to process." I'm thinking to myself, my reputation sort of preceded me. And she said, "Wow, that's awesome." And I'm like, "Oh, wow, it's incredible." She said, "Wow, don't you think it'd be good if you forgave your mom?" The truth of the gospel. Sometimes it comes to you in this joyful moment of woo, and other times you have this feeling of, "Oh, that's right. God has forgiven me of much, and I'm commanded to forgive as Christ has forgiven me." And I can tell you honestly, as a pastor today, I can tell you as a Christian at that moment, that I didn't feel like talking to my mom. That wasn't on my to-do list. It hadn't even crossed my mind in a long time. But having the sting on my conscience by the Holy Spirit, as provided through these words of this girl in my youth group, that night I called my mom. And we have an excellent relationship. We really do. And I've been so blessed. And I'm grateful that even though we had 3 lost years, the fruit that came out of that conversation that would happen that night is so excellent that I haven't lost more years. That's been 23 years ago or so. And it's remarkable to consider what has happened since. I don't even really remember that period of time. And I just share that story, not to just share a personal story, but I share that story because there are probably people who are listening who feel like there is a situation that's completely broken. Maybe it's with a parent, maybe it's with a child, maybe it's with a friend, maybe it's with a fellow believer, but it's somebody where there's been a relationship and it's been so strained. And I want to encourage you that the God who is able to restore the relationship between Jacob and Esau is still able to restore broken relationships today. And I wish I was ending there today, but I'm not. And I wish I was, because I could talk about just like the goodness of relationships and how things, work out. And I could even kind of give that idea that, hey, things always work out and things are great. But we live in a fallen world. And sometimes there are conflicts, and then there are reactions to those conflicts that just seem to make problems even worse. Now, the next narrative that I'm going to read from Genesis chapter 34, I am going to provide a disclaimer. There is some adult content here. There are some things that happen in the Word of God that are just depictions of historical facts, and not all historical facts are things that people of all ages need to consider at specific times. There is an appropriateness to that, and I just share that as a disclaimer. If you're listening to this and you have children in your car, as you're listening on the radio, or if you're listening on the podcast, I just want to just share with you that you know what your children are able to listen to and what they are not. This is going to deal with an assault, so I'm just going to say it that way. So I don't want to trigger anybody if you're somebody who is sensitive to that subject for whatever reason. But I'm going to begin reading Genesis 34. It says, "Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, born to Jacob, went out to visit the women of the land. When Shechem, son of Hamor, the Hivite, the ruler of that area, saw her, he took her and he raped her. His heart was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. And Shechem said to his father Hamor, get me this girl as my wife. When Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled, his sons were in the fields with his livestock, so he did nothing about it until they came home. Then Shechem's father Hamor went out to talk with Jacob. Meanwhile, Jacob's sons had come in from the fields as soon as they heard what had happened. They were shocked and furious because Shechem had done an outrageous thing in Israel by sleeping with Jacob's daughter, a thing that should not be done. But Hamor said to them, 'My son Shechem has his heart set on your daughter. Please give her to him as his wife. Intermarry with us. Give us your daughter and take our daughters for yourselves. You can settle among us. The land is open to you. Live in it. Trade in it. Acquire property in it.' Then Shechem said to Dinah's father and brothers, 'Let me find favor in your eyes, and I will give you whatever you ask. Make the price for the bride and the gift I am to bring as great as you would like, and I'll pay whatever you ask me. Only give me the young woman as my wife.' Because their sister Dinah had been defiled, Jacob's sons replied deceitfully as they spoke to Shechem and his father Hamor. They said to him, 'We can't do such a thing. We can't give our sister to a man who is not circumcised. That would be a great disgrace to us. We will enter into an agreement with you on one condition only, that you become like us by circumcising all of your males. Then we will give your daughters and take your daughters for ourselves. We'll settle among you and become one people with you. But if you will not agree to be circumcised, we'll take our sister and go.' Their proposal seemed good to Hamor and his son Shechem. The young man, who was the most honored of all his father's family, lost no time in doing what they said because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. So Hamor and his son Shechem went to the gate of their city to speak to the men of the city. 'These men are friendly towards us,' they said. 'Let us live in our land and trade in it. The land has plenty of room for them. We can marry their daughters and they can marry ours. But the men will agree to live with us as one people only on the condition that our males be circumcised, as they themselves are. Won't their livestock, their property, and all other animals become ours? So let us agree to their terms, and they will settle among us.' All the men who went out of the city gate agreed with Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male in the city was circumcised." Now listen to this. 3 days later, while all of them were still in pain, two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and attacked the unsuspecting city, killing every male. They put Hamor and his son Shechem to the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and left. The sons of Jacob came upon the dead bodies and looted the city where their sister had been defiled. They seized their flocks and herds and donkeys and everything else of theirs in the city and out in the fields. They carried off all their wealth and all their women and children, taking as plunder everything in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, 'You have brought trouble on me by making me obnoxious to the Canaanites and Perizzites, the people living in the land. We are few in number, and if they join forces against me and attack me, I and my household will be destroyed.' But they replied, 'Should he have treated our sister like a prostitute?'" Now, what just took place in this narrative? There are people who, and I can't wrap my head around this, but there are people who read narratives like this in the Bible, and they say, "Well, see, the Bible condones sexual assault." And I literally have no idea how they come to that conclusion, because they say, "Well, it's in the Bible." Well, yes, the Bible records a lot of bad actors. It records a lot of depraved human behavior, which exposes the need for a savior. It reveals the wickedness of the fallen world apart from the true and holy and righteous God. That's what we expect to see in the fallen world. This is not blessing the actions of Shechem. This is not tolerating it at all. Instead, it's addressing what happened, and it clearly describes what took place in gross moral terms. It is saying that what took place was evil. It describes it as evil in a few ways. We find that the sons of Jacob respond with outrage. They are angered. This is the proper response of holy people. They should be angry at the thought of sexual sin, especially of sexual assault. God's people who would look past such assault, such immorality, those who would look past that for the sake of earthly gain, for their possessions, for their reputation, for an institution, are an abomination to God. This is a time for men of God to be filled with holy rage and respond accordingly and forcefully to evil in the world. That is the way that the sons of Jacob respond. They respond appropriately in their emotions to the sinful actions of Shechem and even his father Hamor. But I do want to talk about those sinful actions for just a moment. Shechem doesn't even consider Dinah as a person. He does not consider her in those sort of ways. Instead, he describes her or thinks of her in terms of, what do I want? What do I desire? And so I will take what I desire. This is the heart of idolatry. This is the wicked heart. It desires more gratification unto itself at all costs, and it doesn't consider any of the consequences. Once one has rejected God's plan for morality, once one has rejected God's plan for human sexuality, one man plus one woman for life, the minute that that construct begins to break down, I don't mean a construct as in a man-made construct, I mean instead an institution ordained by God. The minute that that institution begins to break down, then people begin to gratify their flesh in whatever ways they are able. And what's really disturbing is that there are people who will walk alongside somebody and endorse and celebrate their behavior. Hamor here, rather than condemning his son, he actually doesn't consider or react to the assault of Dinah at all in any moral terms. He doesn't condemn him. He doesn't speak of his actions as wicked. Instead, he thinks, well, how can we clean this up? So he says, let's just justify it through marriage and say it's a marriage and call it a day and everything's fine. But there's a problem. Dinah is a woman made in the image of God. She has intrinsic value. She matters. She matters to God. She matters to her family, and her family couldn't simply let this pass. So what do they do? These sons of Jacob are pretty, I would say, scheming, conniving, wise, depending on your perspective. But they decide that they are going to take matters into their own hands. And so they have these men circumcised. You could just imagine adult men being circumcised and the sort of pain that would follow that. And people would not be really in their best fighting shape. And so the sons of Jacob decide this is a great time to attack, and they are successful in their conquest of them. Now, Jacob's reaction should not be viewed in worldly terms alone and say, well, look, he's just looking out for his own. And he's condemning them because of their behavior. Jacob's concerns that he stresses in verse 30 of, look, we're in a land where we are outnumbered and these people could hate us. And if they were to attack us, we wouldn't be able to stand. This is just a calculation of one who is responsible. Remember, in this family structure, the patriarch is responsible for the family, and he's thinking about how to best take care of his family and provide and protect them. And so that's where his mindset is. The sons are thinking along the lines of honor. They replied, should we have treated our sister like a prostitute? Now, because of their actions, later on, when we get to Genesis chapter 49 and Jacob blesses his sons, we're going to find that he actually passes over these two sons for their blessing, and it's going to be because of their violence. And this is what he's going to be referencing when we get to that chapter. The question is going to be, though, how is God going to take care of them? Because they are outnumbered and they have just done this thing that people in this area might not exactly find satisfactory. We find that this is an opportunity for Jacob to consider the spiritual condition of his entire household. They likely have become contaminated by false worship, and we know that because of idolatry that is described in the next few verses. He's a man who looks at his household and he says, probably there have been times where I haven't been as faithful of a follower of God as I should be. And I have tolerated some things in my household that I should not. But now that we're in a devastating situation, a difficult situation where our safety is at risk, I'm going to cry out to God for help. And I'm going to get serious in a new way. And I'm going to call my family to get serious in a new way in our relationship with God. I always wonder, you know, why sometimes difficulties befall our households, why sometimes conflict arises. And without diving into the entire problem of evil and suffering and all of that, I do want to say this, that sometimes God allows situations to happen to us, or because we live in a fallen world, situations simply do happen to us. And God enables those situations that could, you know, otherwise destroy us to be an opportunity for us to recognize our dependence on Him, to recognize how broken we are, how need we are of His blessing, His protection, His deliverance. Jacob recognizes his spiritual condition here. And I want to pause there for just a moment. I had a person I was talking to not too long ago who said, you know, if I'm dying, and this individual was dying, and said, if I'm dying and I cry out to God then, is God going to reject me because I waited to respond to Him until I knew my situation was dire? And my answer to that was no. How foolish would it be for you to respond otherwise? God in His graciousness has given you warning signs so that you would recognize the season, so you would repent, so you would run to Him. It is a measure of God's blessing that you know your condition so that you might come to Him. Jacob receives a measure of God's grace here. He recognizes his danger and he responds in faith. It says that Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, get rid of all the foreign gods you have with you and purify yourselves and change your clothes. And then come, let us go up to Bethel where I will build an altar to God. That's exactly what they do. They cry out to God. They trust in Him. They turn away from anything that was part of their false worship, anything that was idolatry, even the clothes that they wore that could have been contaminated because they engaged in false worship while wearing them. They leave all of that behind. If you're at a place where you recognize your condition is dire and you're saying, I know that I need to pursue the Lord, then strip off anything that holds you back, any part of false worship, and run towards God. Again, it is His graciousness that enables you to see your true spiritual condition. It is an invitation for God today to run close to Him. Because Jacob does, and he trusts the Lord in faith. And again, I just want you to note the radical difference in Jacob's character from just a few chapters ago because of his response in faith. It says that the terror of God fell on all the towns around them so that no one pursued them. Nobody would pursue them. We're going to find that he's going to settle in the land, that they are going to be blessed. They're going to be semi-nomadic. He's going to follow actually sort of the direction that Abraham had traveled in. He's going to establish some households in some areas where his animals are able to graze, and then he would have to move on at other points. Tragically, the 35th chapter would end with the death of Rachel while giving birth to Benjamin, and we find the death of Isaac at the end of the 35th chapter. Another patriarch has now passed in our reading. Rachel has passed also. But we find that the one who remains, the patriarch who remains, Jacob, that he is a man of faith. He is a man now who has been transformed by his encounter by God, and he is a man who is walking in the blessings of God. What a wonderful thing. I want to talk more next week about the sort of transformation that God does in the human heart. I want to look at how he does this through the narrative of Joseph. Now, Joseph's faith actually was a foreshadowing, how his life was a foreshadowing of the works of Jesus Christ. So we're going to dive into that next week. May the Lord bless you.